So when I read the Mueller report, my hope was everything would come out clean. And actually, as I started to read through it, we got through volume one, you know, my staff and I were reading it, each of us. And I thought, okay, well, there's nothing too problematic for the president himself here. But then as I went into volume two, with the obstruction of justice, evidence that was presented, it got to the point where I said, there is a real problem here. There's a pattern of behavior. There's clear evidence that would be indictable. And I don't really have any choice but to say what is right, and that's that there was impeachable conduct. So I didn't really want to, I was hoping to find nothing in there. I really didn't want to go down that road. Look, I have a responsibility to my constituents to say what's right.
That was Congressman Justin Amash on the local ABC affiliate 13 On Your Side in Michigan, one day after noisily declaring his independence from the Republican Party in a July 4th op-ed in the Washington Post. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I am Matt Welch, joined by at least two other people who are appearing with me, as well as me, tonight on Fox Business Network's Kennedy Program, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu-War. Hi, gang.
Hey, Matt.
Hi.
Happy Monday.
So, Peter, when I first read Amash's breakup note, the first thing I thought of was your remarkably prescient piece from 3 weeks before that. Justin Amash isn't just rebelling against Trump. He's fighting against the two-party system, in which you asserted that what Amash was really doing with his critique is talking about the ways that partisanship has made Congress less willing to exercise its constitutional duties as a co-equal branch of government. How has Amash's explanation over the last few days kind of reinforced that notion or amplified it, Peter Suderman?
Yeah, so I mean, thank you for calling me remarkably prescient, but I think that all I was really doing was reading what Amash had already written in his initial tweet storms. And they were pretty clear. Yes, they were attacks on Trump. I don't think that you could say that they weren't. He is saying that the president engaged in impeachable acts, and he has further amplified that by saying, you know, he thinks Pelosi was wrong not to pursue impeachment. And so he's taken that a little further. But what he's really doing is making an institutional critique of a system in which blind partisanship has not even become the primary goal, but the only goal, especially in the Republican Party. And I think, though he didn't say this directly, I think it's very much a critique of Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell is an extremely effective partisan tactician who runs the Senate in a way that is designed to do one thing and only one thing, and that is preserve and expand the number of Republicans in the Senate, and thus preserve and expand Mitch McConnell's own personal power. There is almost no actual ideological end, unless you count what he's doing with the courts. But even the courts, I think Mitch McConnell wants to have conservative right-of-center judges on the courts, in large part because there are rulings that they issue that have impacts on elections, and those elections put Republican butts in seats in the House and in the Senate. And I think that is a thing that I hear frequently from folks who work on the Hill who are disgruntled with the Republic, who are in the Republican Party but disgruntled with it, that they really dislike the way McConnell has led the Senate and what it has done to the Republican Party and the way that it has just gotten rid of all of the kind of ideological and policy goals that they might have, and instead turned the entire thing into a sort of pure partisan play that's just about holding and expanding the number of Republican seats.
Nick, when Amash talks about how the largest plurality of voters out there aren't necessarily partisan Republicans or partisan Democrats, but people who self-identify as independents, and they tend to be turned off by the political culture war, it all sounded a little bit familiar.
Yeah, a little bit.
To me. So I guess my question or challenge is, and so what? By which I mean, we're at a time of heightened polarization and we have a two-party system. So is it really plausible to kind of lead by example within elected politics by placing yourself above and or beyond all of that?
Yeah, it may not turn out to be a great strategy for Amash himself, but I do think it's like one of the few cards he has to play, both in that interview with the local affiliate, as well as the one with Jake Tapper on CNN, which is also online all over the place. He stressed, you know, the absolute inability to really reform anything from within the party. And I think, you know, the question is whether or not more people pay attention to this and whether or not a couple of other congressmen either flip or become independent, or we start talking about things in terms of being independent of your party leadership. You know, I think it's a real long, you know, it's a Hail Mary pass, to say the least. But I think it's getting to something that people are feeling. The amount of polarization is extremely strong. It's only getting worse. And at the same time, you know, the number of people who are invested in these identities is declining. So at some point, something's got to give. And it might just be that Amash, you know, is the canary in the coal mine, but doesn't really reap any benefit from it.
Catherine, you had the guy on stage a half a year ago and asked him about possibly running for, actually, you asked him what would a third party or independent presidential candidate look like. And he kind of went crazy. Had been obviously thinking about it a lot. So what does your spidey sense tell you about the way he's answering questions about a potential presidential run now?
I mean, I think Suderman has the monopoly on spidey sense on this podcast, but but my, you know.
In the new Spider-Man movie, they keep referring to it as the spidey tingle.
Eesh. No, thank you.
Yep. And that's actually the reaction you're supposed to have.
Okay. That's, I did then have that reaction. And also, I guess the other Spider-Man movie says, like, we're all Spider-Man. So I don't know. But anyway, Justin Amash is also Spider-Man. And as Matt, you have written very eloquently, the polls, while not definitive, don't look great for him in his district. Michigan, of course, has a rigged game in which they have straight ballot voting. You just go in, you check the Republican box, you leave. That's going to screw him over pretty seriously. And if and when he loses or looks like he's going to lose, I don't see why he wouldn't go ahead and do the LP thing. Like, otherwise, what was all of this for? But I also think never underestimate the ability of the Libertarian Party. God bless them. I'm glad they exist. But to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, like, they will be staring. They will look at Justin Amash. They will look at this incredibly, like, principled, attractive candidate who has done all the work to make himself well positioned for the nomination. And then they'll be like, nah, we're going to nominate somebody no one has ever heard of who wears a hat made of tinfoil. Like, that is the Libertarian Party consistently has a very strong impulse to do that. I think that impulse has, if anything, been strengthened in the wake of the Gary Johnson, Bill Weld situation. I would genuinely not count out the LP somehow not giving him the nomination if he decides to seek it, at least soft seek it.
Let's be clear, though, here. The LP isn't going to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat.
They're going to snatch worst defeat from the jaws of defeat.
Right. Yes. They're going to, like, less embarrassing defeat from the... Yeah.
But I actually think for the LP, victory is not winning the presidency, right? Like, that's fine. They're doing a very worthy project about third parties and getting the principles out there. And if they increase their vote total, that's, you know, their vote percentage, like, that's genuinely valuable. I think Amash could really do that. I hope that he gets the chance.
I, as the person who hangs out with Libertarian Party members more than others here, and in fact, I'm going to be moderating a debate this weekend in Massachusetts with a half a dozen presidential candidates there. So it should be pretty interesting to watch that. I think that Amash would win on the first ballot, given everything.
I hope so. If that happens, I would be delighted, and that would be the best outcome, certainly for the LP, probably for Amash as well, though I would like him to ideally not run twice. Like, he should do this LP run thing. He should get his message out there, and then he should, I don't know, get a real job.
Ooh, he's a lawyer, so that's not...
He should learn to code.
That's not possible. There's been a lot of reactions to this, as one can well imagine. One of the consistent ones that we've seen are people re-stressing that there aren't actually any libertarians out there, that it's based on scattershot model that was out in the world in 2017, and that the economic libertarianism in particular has, like, zero audience. Nick, you just said right out there. What is your response to the overall critique that libertarianism is the most lonely quadrant in the fictitious four-sided square.
Yeah, wow. I'm sorry. I kind of went into a fugue state there, Matt. But, you know, there is a, you know, the typology, which shows something like 3 or 4% of people being in a kind of economically conservative, fiscally liberal quadrant of American politics. That's one way of slicing it up, but there are other ways. I mean, that's the Lee Drutman kind of typology. But if you talk to people like Emily Eakins, the former head of polling at Reason, who's now at Cato, it changes because actually when you start to look at stuff, there's, you know, a range that could be anywhere from 10 to 20% or 7 to 22% or whatever. There's a large number of people out there who I think fit comfortably into virtually any plausible definition of libertarian. And more important, the real question is what's going on with conservatives and liberals? Because, you know, I mean, consistently in self-identification, as if from an ideological point of view, conservatives have always been the largest group in any kind of American poll, like a national poll, but they don't actually do that well in the office. So there's some kind of massive slippage between, you know, whatever people are calling themselves as conservative and when they go to vote. And I think that kind of tension is only going to get stronger under Trump because he's clearly not a conservative in a way that even 10 years ago, people in the Republican Party would have been comfortable identifying with.
But also these same people, these, I mean, the Venn diagram of these two groups isn't exactly a circle, but there is a lot of overlap between the people who are now writing the actually there are no libertarians take and the people who buy into this line, like the kind of Tucker Carlson types saying, you know, libertarianism, libertarian values have been ascendant for too long in this country and they have undermined our family values and our and capitalism is actually bad. And I mean, again, I recognize that these are A, not necessarily 100% contradictory arguments. You could say there are no self, there are not very many self-identified libertarians or people who could be fairly tightly classed as libertarians, but also the kind of pro-growth mentality and pro-capitalist mentality has been ascendant for too long. You could say that, but it's a weird place to stake out. And the only reason you would have to stake it out is if you're just team Trump or team GOP.
Suderman, I heard I was speaking at a Students for Liberty retreat 10 days ago or so, and we were BSing afterwards. And one of the questions put to me, and we've had other conversations about this before in our greater universe, was why is it that libertarians only win on social issues and they never win on economic issues? This comes up again just in the looking at and analyzing the Amash thing and why, you know, this shows a certain impotence. What's your take on why that is, or if that is in fact true?
I think there's an element of truth to it, but it's not completely true. And I would point to decades of deregulation starting in the late 1970s. Those are, they're not economic issues in the way that Medicare is, but industry deregulation is a real thing that has happened over the last 40 years and has changed the economy in basically in a good way, and is a win for libertarians. To a lesser extent, but not to no extent, I think that the tax reductions that started under Reagan that have continued under Trump represent sort of at least partial wins or imperfect wins for libertarians. As everybody knows, I had issues with the tax bill that passed in 2017. At the same time, the corporate rate reduction was, if you take it out of context, if you're not sort of looking at the larger budget picture, it's a good idea. That is a thing that libertarians and libertarian economists have been arguing for forever. Welfare reform in the 1990s under Clinton, the dropping budget deficits under Clinton. I mean, these are all maybe not big long-term entitlement reform type wins for libertarians, but they are meaningful movement in the direction of more libertarian economic policy. That said, on some of the biggest economic policy issues, yeah, libertarians don't win a lot. Like Social Security and Medicare in particular are not places where libertarians have just like won, you know, had huge successes, and they are the biggest part of the federal budget. And that continues to be an issue. I think that this is sort of going to have to come to a head over the next couple of decades. I will say it again. I've said it many times before. Medicare is going to be insolvent. One of the trust funds, not all of them, but one of them, the major trust fund in Medicare, is going to be insolvent in 2026. That is two presidential elections away. At that point, that part of the fund will only be able to pay 89% of its bills. That amount will decline. And then in the mid-2030s, Social Security will also become insolvent and it won't be able to pay all of its bills. And that's going to really hit a generation of retirees. And Congress is not going to be able to do what Congress is doing right now, which is pretend the problem doesn't exist. And neither are presidential candidates. People are going to have to start talking about this and have to start proposing some sort of response, even if that response is, you know what? We'll just pay. We will just not fund these programs. But whatever it is, there is going to be a response and a change to those programs over the next decade or two.
One of the interesting things to observe in not even necessarily tethered straight to Amash, but in the resurgence of people trying to wrap their heads around the new nationalism and whatnot, the Tucker Carlsonization of the right, are people who once self-identify as at least half libertarian, or, you know, Tucker Carlson worked was an adjunct scholar at Cato, among other things. So this morning I read Daniel McCarthy, who, not a libertarian, but has been fluent in some libertarianese and certainly has written for Reason, writes the following. And Nick, I would like you to kind of grapple with this. Amash was never comfortable with populism, but libertarianism without populism has no market at all. Ron Paul won despite losing. Amash teaches libertarians simply how to lose by losing. What say you, Nicholas?
Yeah, that's all well and good. Again, I think, and this is partly what Catherine was getting at, that, conservatives are protesting a little too much that there are no libertarians or there is no libertarian threat or temptation to the right side of the political spectrum. You know, the fact of the matter is that, like, libertarian goals do win on a wide variety of culture battles. That has happened. I think I'm actually getting more optimistic about a shift in large scale public financing. You know, we obviously I have a debt problem. Peter was talking about entitlements. I think one of the things that may happen over the next 4 to 6 years is a generational shift in leadership. And it means what it means to be libertarian is going to change from what it might mean now or what it meant 10 years ago. But I think, you know, there is going to be a moment where younger legislators actually start grappling with entitlement spending, and they're going to have a different perspective to it than Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi. And hopefully they'll get out ahead of it a little bit.
Just before we bounce out, quick answers from all of you. Is this a good thing, what Justin Amash did?
Absolutely. It's fantastic. And anytime somebody does something based on principle in the full glare of, the Washington media, that's always good.
Catherine?
Yes. And I base that on my very important focus group I am currently conducting. I am out on Long Island with a bunch of fancy pants Manhattan liberal types, and all of them that I bumped into yesterday said, "Hey, what's going on with this Amash fella?" which is good, because it means they know who Justin Amash is and that there are Republicans who are not on board with the current form of the Republican Party, and that's information they might not have had before.
Spoken like a true cosmetarian. Suderman?
Yes. I definitely think it's good. Party leadership is a problem, and the kind of the partisan stranglehold on American politics that both Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi have is a bad thing. But it is the party leadership only has the power that party members give them. And Amash is showing that actually a congressman, even if that person is not in leadership, even if that person may not win their seat back, has a lot of power, at least to get noticed, to get out a message, and to take a stand. And I think that's a good, being independent like that and showing that sort of independence is something that we need more of in politics. And it's useful not just to kind of say it every now and then, but to actually go ahead and do it. Justin Amash is a model for other legislators.
I just to throw my 1 cent in, I enjoy the truth serumization that such gestures can induce, whether through the person himself. I don't think that Amash is necessarily changing what he's talking about. Maybe some of the emphases or some of the transparency is slightly different, but also in the way that it affects how other people look at things. Even if, regardless of what you think about impeachment, for example, the way that he has talked about Nancy Pelosi's treatment towards impeachment has kind of changed the way that I look at it. He just sort of points out, like, if she really believes that he's engaged in impeachable conduct, she should her job description is that she should launch proceedings. And there's it's an interesting way of looking at that, which I didn't necessarily think of that way before. Let's switch gears.
And well, why doesn't she is because she believes, perhaps not incorrectly, she believes that doing impeachment would cost Democrats seats in the House. It is just about maintaining electoral power.
And I think the Amash analogs in the Democratic Party are an interesting sort of bizarro case study, which I think maybe I actually just jumped your transition, Matt. I'm sorry. Did you have a terrible segue planned?
I wasn't going there, but why don't you go ahead and go there? Because it's interesting. And it's also in the news over the weekend.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, you know, Amash called out Pelosi specifically as the Democratic Trump, right? As the sort of the figure to whom all other players in the party owe fealty and pay fealty. But, you know, this weekend there was a big fuss after Pelosi explicitly got her panties in a bunch and gave an interview to the New York Times where she condemned Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her three cronies, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley, who voted against the border funding bill. And they did it on principle. And, you know, that is not a crew that I would want to represent my interests generally. I do not sign on to their policy platform overall, but they're right about the border. They are right about the fact that this Pelosi bill is the art of practical politics and not principled politics. And they've all made this a signature issue, and they're just kind of doctor knowing it. Like, we can't sign this bad bill. And I think they're still, you know, they're all newly elected, and their party is not in power broadly in the country right now. And that puts them in a very different position in terms of what their choices are as loyal or disloyal opposition. But they're doing it on principle. They're fighting Pelosi just like Amash and, you know, his very few cronies are fighting Trumpist GOP.
And Peter couldn't help but notice that AOC had a he's right tweet about one of Amash's critiques, which is basically that members of Congress can't really do anything because it's all strangled by leadership above, and that's wrong. The in her response to Pelosi, whose cutting comments are always great when she goes after AOC, she said all these people have their public whatever and their Twitter world.
I always imagine her with those with the deal with it sunglasses, you know, just like putting them on, walking away.
So what AOC says in response is that public whatever is called public sentiment, and wielding the power to shift it is how we actually achieve meaningful change in this country. It sounds kind of like an institutional or a institutional / process fight on some level. Suderman, who's more right about this, or are they both right and we should all start drinking?
Who is the most right about this is Justin Amash, who in the in the clip that we heard at the beginning of this show said there's nothing wrong with parties generally, but the problem is, and I forget the exact phrase he used, but the problem is blind partisan loyalty above all else when that becomes the priority. And that is the problem. And so in the fight between Nancy Pelosi and AOC, look, parties are not completely useless. I'm not suggesting we abolish them tomorrow, maybe the day after that, but not tomorrow. And party leadership serves an organizing function that is and can be useful. At the same time, when all party decision making sort of ends up in the power of one person or just a handful of people, and the rest of the legislators, the elected officials who've been brought to Washington through the democratic process to represent the interests of their people, are basically said, you're not allowed to do that. You are representing the interests of party leadership and party leadership alone. That's a problem. And so and we have seen that play out in both the Republican and Democratic parties over the last decade or so. I mean, if you think about the way the Tea Party and the House Freedom Caucus, RIP, behaved with John Boehner under Obama. This has been one of the kind of defining fights in Washington, at least since Obama became president.
Nick, there's a Tim Alberta, who's a fine political reporter, has a new book that's come out this week, this month, called American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War. And it was making headlines over the weekend because he interviewed President Trump, and Trump said that he's been following Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's career for a long time and is fascinated by her and all of this. This might be an unfair question, but just give you something to riff on. Clearly, AOC has a certain kind of game. And that game, especially on social media, has some similarities to President Trump's game. And we've talked about that before. And part of this is like it's enjoyable on some level. And part of it is that maybe it's reflective of things that are more pathological in our politics. Can those people who are kind of products of where we're at right now become the change agents, to get us out of it? Or do you see it more as a negative thing and let's just get entertainment value?
I think that they obviously can become the change agents. If you know, the question is, can they sell it? And I think AOC is actually doing a really good job, like Trump, of selling to a base but not really expanding the base. And I think that there's a lot of inherent problems with the whole democratic socialist project, because it fundamentally is unserious. It catastrophizes everything, and it makes everything into a war of all against all. But it doesn't really explain why its particulars are necessary in a convincing way, other than to say that the world is going to end in 12 years, so we need to increase everybody's taxes right now, that type of stuff. So I think so. And I see this as we are obviously being pushed off the stage anyway with the passage of time. But like there's a generational shift coming that has taken longer than expected for a variety of reasons and may not take place until after 2020. But, you know, it's changing. It's happening. And it's not going to be what we understood as Republican and Democratic policies for much longer.
This AOC tweet that was in response to the Pelosi comments in the Times is a great example of that, right? She said on Saturday, "I find it strange when members act as though social media isn't important. I haven't dialed for dollars once this year and have more time to do my actual job. Yet we'd rather campaign like it's 2008. Now, first of all, oh my God, 2008
that was
is last
so
week.
So long ago.
So, I mean, to sort of use this controversy to make all of those points inside a tweet, it shows that AOC, like Trump, is, she's not just reactively tweeting. Like, she is doing that also, but she's doing it in the service of a different vision of doing politics, a different vision of how you communicate with people. And I think the other tweet, which I will read just very quickly, Ilhan Omar, the next day, showed how, like, there's a bad version of that same tweet when she wrote, they're just salty about who is wielding power to shift public sentiment these days, sis. Sorry, not sorry. Right? Like, that's the worst Trump tweet version of the AOC tweet. But Trump actually sometimes does his version of that smarter, more argument-packed AOC tweet. It's just both of their arguments are generally bad.
Peter, I heard you trying to jump in. You want to cap it off?
Yeah, I just want to take a little bit of issue with what Nick was saying about whether AOC and Trump are only talking to the base. And I would add Bernie Sanders into this conversation. If you look at what Bernie Sanders has done, he has mainstreamed the idea of single-payer health care, Medicare for all. He just by sort of talking about it, by doing the kind of 1980s, 1990s, aught 2008 version, and then eventually, sort of through social media and through political organizing, has pushed a lot of the Democratic socialist agenda into the mainstream, certainly of the Democratic Party, into mainstream news coverage, he has forced or allowed, take your pick, people who want to take it seriously in a way that even 6 or 8 years ago under Obama, Sanders's ideas were not taken seriously. And so I think Ocasio-Cortez is doing something similar, mostly for worse when it comes to policy. But I do think that they're having an impact beyond the base, that they are mainstreaming ideas. I hope that Justin Amash ends up doing something similar, mainstreaming some outsider ideas and pushing them to the fore of national politics.
I think the signal achievement of Bernie Sanders so far on the national stage has been to elect Donald Trump president.
Oh,
I mean, he weakened Hillary Clinton, and Peter, partly because of single payer and all of that, and the faint to the left. But what I'm saying is that these guys do very well within a universe of Twitter and of social media or of legacy media, but It strikes me as way premature to say that AOC is actually converting people into democratic socialists.
Switching gears, the Trump administration over the weekend apparently had to replace its entire legal team on account of the entire legal team saying we're not going to do this anymore in arguing in court over whether it can add or the census can add a question about citizenship in the standard decennial form that it sends out to everybody. The Supreme Court late last month, you will recall, in one of its final rulings, said that the administration violated the Administrative Procedures Act in its justifications for adding the question, which was a bunch of gobbledygook about how, oh, no, we really want to better enforce the Voting Rights Act. That's why we're doing it. So now Trump has changed his mind a bunch of times, the administration has, about what to do next. There's talk about perhaps doing some kind of executive order to make it happen. I don't know how that would work legally. And Trump sort of let slip in an interview on Friday, I believe, that one of the reasonings behind this is that it's for the apportionment of congressional maps. And everybody who has looked at this honestly has said that if you add the question, it's going to make the redrawing of congressional maps more favorable to the Republican Party. So bunch of legal gobbledygook there, and apologies for word repetition. But Catherine, I want to go to you on a first principles type of question first, since you're in charge. Should the census ask respondents their citizenship status?
I think I'm going to go with the J.D. Tuchili approach here, which is just like government should know less things about people, probably. I think, you know, the function of the census is indeed, you know, built into our very early founding documents. It is indeed to do this thing, to figure out how to do representation according to rules that we have agreed upon. At the same time, you know, don't put your name on government lists is good advice for everyone, and especially good advice for illegal immigrants, which our current battle over the DACA beneficiaries / Dreamers has shown. So I think, to my mind, the gerrymandering angle is somewhat secondary to just the very simple human angle of, you know, no illegal immigrant in their right mind should answer that question, should fill out a census at all. And creating a condition where people don't feel like they can trust what's going to happen with the information they give to the government, while accurately reflecting the fact that people cannot trust what's going to happen with information they give to the government, is probably not a good thing overall for the Republic. Other news today about federal agencies using driver's license databases to build creepy facial recognition software.
I should add that the gerrymandering angle for me is most interest in just in terms of intent, which has been pretty clear from the get-go from the like of Kris Kobach, the former Secretary of State of Kansas, who pushed for the question early and for other people over the years.
Shouldn't the question, I think the answer is that, yeah, they should, because, Matt, and you've written about this, the whole point of the census, it's not about, it's the number of residents. It's the number of people who live in a particular area for a congressional district. Their legal status doesn't actually matter. So if you want a accurate account, according to the Constitution, we should know how many people are living in a particular area.
Right. So that says no citizenship question would be the
yeah, or that you ask it, but everybody answer it.
Well, so the problem
won't
with the
answer it if you're right, trying to get a more accurate count.
You understand that, but then you also know if you're not asking it, you're not getting an accurate count. So.
Why?
I think the you count people
because
more
you know
accurately.
A large number of people are refusing to participate.
No, I think that's not right. The issue is that if you put the census, the citizenship question on the census, it is believed, I think accurately, that fewer immigrants will respond to the census, and therefore it will inaccurately count the number of people.
Fair enough. Thank you. Yes.
So, Peter, analyze this from your Trump administration dysfunctional point of view. There's a Washington Post headline from this morning saying the Trump administration has changed its story on the census citizenship question at least 10 times in 4 months.
Yeah, so I will also read you a headline from the good website Reason.com, which you should all read and consume daily. It's a headline on a piece by Jacob Sullum, who wrote, "The Trump administration's double reversal on the census highlights the difficulties of dealing with a mercurial president who rules by tweet." Yes, that. I would like to associate myself with everything that Jacob Sullum says in that headline and also in the rest of the piece, which is basically Trump's a crazy person who is erratic and can't be relied on to make consistent decisions. And that just makes the business of government exceptionally difficult.
Catherine, there's another one of these teaching moments, I think, that no one will learn from, which is to say that, as you alluded to, the original written right there in the Constitution purpose of the census was to count the number of people living here permanently who are not subject to foreign crowns and whatnot. All right. Those definitions have changed over the years for a very good reason. In some cases, the whole three-fifths thing at the beginning was a little bit problematic. So there have been updates to it. But the constitutional purpose is we're going to count residents so that we can decide every 10 years how to to apportion the number of seats in Congress, period. And there are residents who are, you know, in the 1890s, couldn't vote, called women, who are part of that. There's children.
I have heard of these people.
There are people who are not citizens yet, might be going through the process. There's all number of people who were understood to be representative, or that representation, it was understood to include them as well. So given that very narrow constitutional thing, suddenly we have so many damn questions on even the standard form, not the long form, which was discontinued in 2010, precisely because when you ask 1,000 questions, people don't answer because it's a hassle. It feels like, hey, this is a great moment to remind us that if you give government the power to ask this question under some kind of penalty if you don't answer, they're going to just expand it forever. And yet we don't see a lot of people saying, let's pare it all back. Damn it, Catherine. Lament that out loud.
I would be happy to. Damn it, Matt. They don't. They never pare it back. Yeah, I mean, I think this is right. Like, there are lots of totally well-meaning, good people who just are saying, hey, while we're sending out this questionnaire, could we ask a couple of other things? After all, information is good. Information helps us make better choices. And that is a reasonable sounding thing to say. You know, this is actually the, hey, a little more information can't hurt argument is in many ways the basis of the entire Elizabeth Warren campaign. And certainly like the Yang gang also, like there is a sort of technocratic impulse there to just quantify stuff. And then once we know where all the things are, we can be better. And the census is especially subject to that. But yeah, it has a very simple purpose. That simple purpose could be fulfilled, I think, on a postcard. If we're doing our taxes on a postcard, we should do our census on a postcard too. And then everything after.
It really should be an e-vite.
It's it's paperless.
Can we get
post,
rid of the postcard?
I think, yeah. Yeah. Everything
Survey
else after
monkey,
that,
right? Survey
is,
monkey.
Yeah. Google poll. I mean, to be honest, though, this is like the fact that we've just described, you know, several other tools to glean information from groups that are easy to use and dynamic and that private people use all the time, and that the government, that we literally have to fight it out in the Supreme Court if you want to add one question to this thing, shows how broken the entire project is. Eric Boehm wrote a great feature for the print magazine about a year ago, where he suggested that we just relinquish all congressional boundary drawing to a computer. It was much more sophisticated than that, and suggested some ways even to work around what might sound like the insurmountable politics of just fighting over the algorithm that the computer would use. But as long as there is, I mean, this is, it gets back to the first part of this podcast. If all you care about is one more seat, two more votes, three more people in the party in power, this is a fight to the death, and it always will be.
Nick, you managed to publish something while we were taping this broadcast.
Sure.
On this question.
Not
so,
a broadcast.
Please tell
I
us.
Also degraded my net worth
podcast.
By about 50%. So,
yeah. Okay. day trading.
Multitasking isn't working out so well for me. But
what did you write about, and what does it all mean?
Oh no, it's just that while we're talking about adding a citizenship question or a legal status question, the number of unauthorized immigrants in the country continues to decline. So that it's one of the many kind of odd emanations of this whole debate, and actually, it's partly about Trump. He ran as a law and order candidate during, one of the most peaceful periods in modern American history. He ran against immigrants as they are coming here in fewer numbers, or illegals anyway. It's an odd kind of reality that we often end up having these arguments about stuff which are no longer, it just doesn't make sense. The high point of illegal immigration came in 2007. We're 10 years away from, or more than that, 12 years away from that. And yet we're acting as if we are barely hanging on by our, by the skin of our teeth.
There's a little bit of a corollary there to Elizabeth Warren's campaign, which is almost entirely predicated on the argument that actually the economy is terrible. This is an argument she's been making mostly under Republican presidents, but for at least 15 years, going back to the early part of the first Bush presidency, and sorry, the second Bush presidency, but the first term. And if you look at the economic numbers, again, there are signs of potential weakness. I'm not saying we could be in a recession by the end of this podcast. At the same time, the numbers are the overall health of the economy is really pretty good, and surveys show that. Consumer spending shows that. There's some reasons. I do believe there's some reasons to be anxious, but it's a kind of an odd argument to be making that the economy is rigged and terrible for most people, given the actual state of unemployment, of GDP, of sort of all of the major
mobility,
right,
et cetera.
No, all the major
we're fundamentally telling like false stories about everyday reality, and I recognize that it's actually really difficult to figure out, is this a good economy or a bad economy on some level? But we're constantly, and Warren is always talking about how the middle class hasn't gotten a raise since, since the reign of Pepin the Short or something like that. And it's just clearly wrong. And we know it's wrong because everywhere around us, people have more stuff at more levels of income. But we're going to go with that. Or we're going to talk about how illegal immigrants are, voting and throwing entire elections, even though nobody can find, more than five people who are in any kind of voting irregularity. And we're going to build a whole system about that, or about how kids are dying because of student loan debt. It's a very peculiar kind of discourse that we're living in.
Catherine, Tyler Cowen wrote over the weekend that he's, or on Friday, that he's in favor of asking the question while also being in favor of greater immigration. And he had an odd formulation, which is addressed to those like Catherine Mangu Ward who don't want to see this question in the form. Do you really wish for your view to be so closely affiliated with the attitude that citizenship is a thing to hide? I would be embarrassed if my own political strategy implied that we not ask individuals about their citizenship on the census form. What say you, Catherine Mangu Ward?
I don't think that's what my view implies. I think, Tyler is, his headline on that piece is actually exactly right, because he has both deep libertarian, though I know that he's always complicating that term, but like he has deep libertarian sentiments, principles, impulses, especially those that with respect to openness. And he has the technocratic impulse. He is, he wants data. And I think this might be one of those examples where Tyler is trying to talk to people who are different than him, which he is astonishingly good at, which is lucky because everyone is different than him. But he misses the mark a little bit, or at least I don't think the thing he's describing in that piece is the median type. It's not somehow that citizenship is not valuable, or that it's not meaningful, or that we shouldn't have data, but that this particular question in this context put into the hands of the people who will then have the data, it's in many ways, it's just a utilitarian case. It's not going to come out to maximize libertarian ends, especially not the ends of long term, the ends of more open immigration.
One of the ironies of all of this, by the way, is that Trump you know, at least as Steve Bannon put it, you know, wanted to deconstruct the administrative state, which allows government agencies to do whatever they want without any real oversight. And, you know, commerce is kind of being taken to the woodshed on this one. And in many ways, Trump's Justice Department is as well. So it's kind of ironic that, you know, the guy who is going to destroy the administrative state is now getting, you know, screwed over because there are actual rules in place where agencies can't just do what they want because they want to, and they're subject to judicial review.
Well, especially when, as Jacob rightly pointed out and Peter alluded to, the execution of that broad administrative authority is so badly done. If he does it correctly, the question is on the census almost certainly, because I don't think the Supreme Court is going to be revisiting that particular power of the census.
Yeah, the Supreme Court's ruling wasn't that this question is completely impermissible right. on the census. It was that you can't do so without a transparent rationale, and the administration's rationale was obviously false. That was conspired after, you know, cooked up after the fact, because what they really wanted was to put the census, the question on the census, in order to make to gerrymander districts in ways that were more favorable to Republicans.
Let's go to our end of podcast. And I said podcast, Catherine.
It sounded damn you. Like broadcast, but, you know, yeah. I'm in distant lands now. Who knows?
What, Catherine, what have you been reading out there on the North Fork of the whatever river?
Yes, of the whatever river. I actually can't remember. I may be repeating a Suderman suggestion, but I will repeat it nonetheless. I am reading Exhalation, the Ted Chiang collection. It's the same guy who wrote the story that the movie Arrival was based on, and it's really, really good. And if you want some good moody short stories to read on the rainy day of your vacation, then this would be a good choice.
Yeah, that was a recommendation of mine, and like I will
double
just
recommend.
Second it again, because his stories are they're all basically logic problems applied to like emotional issues, right? Like they're
oh my God.
You know,
stop telling people everything about us, Peter.
It's so good, right? Because he's like, well, people have feelings, but what if we, instead of talking about feelings the way normal people talk about them, what if we turned them into science problems that were kind of tricky, but that we could solve through a short story?
I don't know why you would be saying that like a hypothetical instead of just Tuesday.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
I am reading The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future by Joseph C. Sternberg, who is a London-based Wall Street Journal columnist, which is very good and kind of telegraphs what it documents how, you know, millennials are taking it on the chin due to baby boomers' greed and rapacity. And then also, being a baby boomer, I suppose, or near the Gen X border, over the weekend I watched Cocktail, the 1988 movie with Tom Cruise, which is a reminder to everybody who doesn't believe in material progress that things are so much better now, including movies, movie soundtracks, actors, stars, supporting
including
players.
Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise is better. Yeah. No, it is a spectacularly bad movie, and it's kind of like in the way that I can watch Roadhouse endlessly and enjoy it both for what it is and on an ironic level. Cocktail is, it's unwatchable.
Also a reminder that cocktails are better.
Yes, that's true. Cocktails and Dreams, I believe, which was the full title of his mass-marketed chain of mall-based boozeteria.
Large cocktail tumbler glass behind the back flipping is
not
better,
do it.
Peter.
Yeah,
it's
no,
just
that's
not
true,
nearly
yeah.
as good. Suderman, what are you doing?
I saw three different movies last week. Spider-Man Far From Home, which I wrote about for Reason.com. Basically, it's fun and forgettable and about fake news. I also saw Hereditary and Midsommar. Hereditary came out last year and Midsommar came out this weekend. They're two films by a quite young director. I believe he's like 31 at this point. Hereditary was his debut. It's horror films by this guy, Ari Aster, who is a kind of young up-and-comer, you know, who has made a mark in arty, low-ish budget horror filmmaking. They're both really, really well-directed movies. Even if you're not like a big horror movie fan, Astor himself has said, well, he is not a huge horror movie fan. Like, he doesn't dislike the genre. What he's doing is he's bringing like a real sort of an art film sensibility, but also a kind of an indie drama sensibility to the horror genre. And in fact, he said that his first movie, you know, he'd come out of film school and he'd had a bunch of scripts that were circulating. And what he really wanted to make was the kind of movie that a young sort of ambitious director might have made in the 80s or 1990s as their first film, was a dark family drama about how a family deals with trauma badly. And he was like, well, you can't make an adult family drama anymore. Nobody will finance that. But what if I filtered that through the lens of horror? I bet it would get financed. And it did. And it's actually pretty great. And it really shows a kind of, among other things, it's scary as hell. And but it also really kind of shows an emotional intelligence about trauma and grief and loss, and how families, how it can kind of destroy and infect families and poison their relationships with each other, that is really absent from a lot of feature filmmaking these days. Anyway, recommended.
Does it include Kokomo by the Beach Boys on its soundtrack?
Not to my knowledge, although I did listen to that song over the weekend.
Did it? Maybe it includes it, but it's played backwards over some kind of Swedish chanting.
Satan.
One more time.
Yeah.
There is so much Swedish chanting in Midsommar. Oh my goodness.
You guys, is it a problem that the previews of those movies, of that movie, like our art director, Johanna Andreessen, who is a crazy Swede and is home in Sweden right now, like, I now am a little bit worried to be alone with her.
What took you so long?
Is she going to bloodily murder me? I should have been worried all along.
If you see the movie, you will become even more worried.
The wall-mounted squirrel in her apartment wasn't enough to get you?
Oh, man.
I will never, never see that movie.
That is really like a callback to this movie in a way that...
So what I consumed was an ass-kicking, by which I mean it was the American ladies winning the World Cup. I watched quite a bit of the run-up. It was one of the greater modern kind of cocky, arrogant, sports, I'm going to win this, you watch moments that we've had in a good long time. Great fun to see them. They really, if they would have lost, it would have been an egg on their face forever. Unlike Joe Namath, who famously called a Jets Super Bowl victory in Super Bowl III when they were underdogs, the U.S. team is super overdog-ish. Their best player, who won the best of the World Cup trophy, Megan Rapinoe, the purple-haired lesbian goddess, was in a huge Twitter fight with Donald Trump that attracted all this attention. There's an equal pay lawsuit, all these things going on. They basically called the shot, but played with this kind of arrogance that was delightful. The world got really mad because they kept doing things like pretending they were drinking tea after scoring a goal against the damn Brits close to July 4th. Just great, entertaining fun. It's always good to see American arrogance on the sporting field pay off.
Speaking of the two overly dominant political figures in the two parties, did you see this morning that Nancy Pelosi has invited them to the Capitol? Since they're not going to the White House?
AOC beat her to that punch by about a
week.
Oh,
really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, of course, Bill de Blasio, the 22nd ranked Democrat running for president, is going to give them a ticker tape parade on Wednesday in the Canyon of Heroes or whatever the hell it is here. But anyways.
Is that going to affect your commute, Matt?
That's funny. That's really funny, Peter. That's all of the shade against people not having offices to work in we have to throw during this podcast. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned next week. And stay tuned all week for great recent podcast material. Rate, review us, all that jazz. And thank you. Goodbye.